It isn't always peaches and cream to prepare sermons and deliver them on Sunday morning, but there are certain benefits, and I am experiencing one of them this morning because I get to say without embarrassment that I am completely in love with the young lady who read the scripture. When you visit Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, it doesn't take long to become aware of the school slogan, which is, "Expect a miracle." The first time I saw it on the floor of their basketball arena, during a game which they lost, I thought it must create quite a challenge to faith. You throw up a last-minute shot with one foot on that sign, and the shot doesn't go in. You'd have to wonder whether you just didn't deserve a miracle or whether the promise is not entirely reliable. It may seem odd, but Jesus told one parable which says, among other things, don't expect a miracle. Before we hear it, I'd like to remind you that a parable is not an exercise in systematic theology. It's a little piece of fiction, a short story skillfully arranged to make one main point. It often begins, like a fairy tale, with a kind of once upon a time flavor. And I think the people who heard the parables first would never have thought of taking them literally. They were not deep in book learning, but they understood poetry instinctively, and the parables are poetry. Our parable this morning from the Gospel of Luke starts, as you heard a moment ago, like this. Once there was a rich man who dressed in purple and the finest linen and feasted in great magnificence every day. Dressed in purple. Not a K-stater, Jack Galbraith. Purple dye was expensive, and so clothing dyed in that color was considered the clothing for those who were enormously wealthy or who sat on thrones. Finest clothes, best food, all the superlatives suggest that this is meant to be the rich man to end all rich men, the ultimate symbol of great wealth, and as it turns out, the ultimate symbol of uncaring wealth. And then, because contrast is the essence of art, we get a violent contrast. At this rich man's gate, covered with sores, lies a man at the other end of the earth, a poor man named Lazarus, who would have been happy in his gnawing hunger for the fallen scraps from the rich man's table. That's all we learn. Because economy is also the name of the game in these little stories. No time is wasted on character sketches of the two men. One has plenty, the other is hopeless, both of them die. The poor man is carried by angels to be with Abraham, which for Jews would mean to be with God in happiness. The rich man winds up in Hades, in misery. So we have now doubled our original contrast. The most hopeless and dejected beggar on earth is overnight elevated to the arms of God. The luckiest man on earth is overnight plunged into total despair. The rich man apparently had no time for compassion on earth. Now, in yet another ironic contrast, he pleads for it. "Take pity on me," he calls out to Father Abraham. "Send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water to cool my tongue, for I am in agony in this punishment." Lazarus had waited patiently for an occasional crumb from the rich man's table. Now the rich man begs for a drop of water from the beggar's plenty. How the simple people must have loved the irony. But Father Abraham speaks harshly. "You had the good things before. Now it's his turn. And besides, there is a gulf between us so deep that no one can cross it." Irony again, because there had been a great gulf between the two men while they were on earth, a kind of economic and social chasm, but it could have been crossed. A moment of will, a few steps, but those merciful steps were never taken. And now, in the afterlife of our story, the gulf has become unbridgeable forever. The rich man now thinks of others, especially of his own family. So he asks if Lazarus could be sent back from the dead to visit his five brothers and warn them to learn compassion, so they would not end up in this place of torment. In other words, he wants a miracle. A ghost come back like that of Hamlet's father to frighten his brothers into changing their lifestyles. But Abraham says, no miracles. They have a sacred book. Let them do what that book tells them. But the rich man knows his brothers well enough to know that an ordinary message will not be shock enough. It would be like expecting Mr. Trump to switch over to humility because of the Beatitudes. So he says, if someone came back from the dead to visit them, then they would change. And Abraham repeats his refusal, let them expect no miracles. The information they need to live well before God is already in their hands. And if they won't pay attention to that, no piece of magic will be provided to get the job done. Now, it would be totally unfair to this parable to think that the fate of the rich man was determined by his wealth. It was determined instead by his relationship to other people. His wealth may have gotten in the way of a better relationship, but the money itself was not to blame. In fact, it might have made him one of God's most useful instruments if he had not allowed it to make him blind. I think the words, "There was once a rich man," give us our first hint that something is wrong in this man's life. Not that it is bad or godless to be rich, any more than it is a sign of goodness or godliness to be poor, but it is a terrible thing if that is the essence of one's biography. If the only comment that can be made about a person is based on finances. If I do a funeral, I try to catch something essential about the person. She was an exceptional mother, or he was a civic leader, or she was, as many of you know, a uniquely loyal friend. Imagine what it would be like if the only thing one could say would be, "He was very rich." But that's all there is to say in this story, Because this story simply does not intend to get tangled up with the real complexities and paradoxes in every human life. It deals in black and white, not in shades of gray. It features a rich bad guy and a poor good guy, caricatures by Croson. It may point us, I found out who reads the editorial page, at least, it may point us toward some useful truth, but we need to know that life is not as perfectly polarized as this cameo-sized short story might suggest. The next parable might feature just as well a good rich man and a vicious poor man. Parables play one game at a time. There is a word for us, however, in this one, and it is our job to find it. The worst way of reading this story is to say, well, I certainly have no fortune, and I'm not embarrassed to wear a shirt from Penny's or eat a hamburger at McDonald's, so the story says nothing to me. I refuse to identify myself with the villain. But the fact is that in some way or other, every one of us is rich. And in whatever world our wealth lies, we too face the question of what we do with it. We may, for example, be intellectually rich, so gifted with the power and the inclination to enjoy good books and high-level dialogue, that we look down with total contempt on those who go plodding along in the flatlands between movie magazines and the inanities of most television. If the woman with an intellectual fortune has never tried to open a better world for those less rich in mind, if she has never wondered whether her own smugness may even have driven them deeper into mental poverty, then her picture is drawn in this parable. Or we may be rich because we have a happy disposition, a legacy from the good health our parents passed on to us, or from the sunny home in which we spent our childhood. How do we feel about that kind of wealth? If we simply take it for granted or credit it to our own good sense and hard work, and if we never wonder how we could help others to share in that good fortune who have none of their own, then we are kin to the careless man who moved so blindly through this parable. We may be rich because we are loved so much by a husband or wife, by children or friends. In our neighborhood, there is a crotchety woman with a tight, bitter mouth from whom everybody runs. When we need to feel superior, to compliment ourselves on our own warm and genial natures, what a welcome contrast she makes. There must be some good reason, we think, why we are loved and she is not. So we agree with ourselves that we deserve our good fortune. It does not occur to us that she may have had only the crumbs from the table of affection, and that we might be like her if we had walked the same road. It may be, of course, that this story is so childlike, so obviously made up, and so burdened with quaint scenery from the first century that we feel no response to it at all. But I would like to remind you that it was this very story that lay behind one of the most remarkable Christian lives of this century, When a young German student read the parable of the rich man and the beggar, it occurred to him that it was his duty to identify the beggar at his own gate, that he himself was rich, not in money, but in intellect and in healing and artistic gifts. He already knew. The question was, who is the beggar? He decided that the beggar at the gate of a brilliant and wealthy white civilization was the black man in Africa. So in a direct response to this parable, he left Europe and went to a hot, steaming rainforest to live for the rest of his life. Some would argue that Albert Schweitzer made the wrong decision, but he never thought so. Schweitzer no more believed in a geographical heaven and hell with blazing fires and deep gulfs than he believed in pots of gold at the ends of rainbows. But he believed absolutely in the message of Jesus Christ and in what he took to be the point of this story, that in whatever way one is gifted, one owes something to those who have missed out. This is the major point of the parable, so I've given it most of the time, but I confess to being fascinated by a minor point, that we wait for a miracle to teach us how to live when the knowledge is all around us. In quiet talks with good friends, in sound advice from good books. Send somebody back from the grave, our man in the parable says, and scare my dull and sleeping brothers into knowing what to do with their lives. And Abraham says, no. Don't expect a miracle. The truth speaks quietly on each day of your brothers' lives. Tell them to listen. It seems to me that the world is full of shouting. Pro-choice and right to life shout stridently at each other. And in the angry commotion, a quiet and thoughtful search for truth becomes a casualty. Preachers on radio and television call for miracles in booming voices. And the miracles almost always seem to have something to do with money, to keep their voices booming and their churches full, and not with those ordinary tragedies of real life that take place in the house next to yours or around the block. So I use the parable this morning to remind us to listen to voices that are not loud and can be lost amidst the shouting, and to remind us to look for small gestures that might be missed, for the movement at the edge of the crowd. I am not much touched in my life by what many people mean when they use the word miracle. That is, an extraordinary event in the physical world which surpasses all known human or natural powers and so must be caused by the direct intervention of God. The miracles in which I rejoice are the wondrous things that happen when people reach beyond themselves in love, put compassion at times ahead of profit, give up some pleasure out of concern for somebody else. The world I see and in which I rejoice makes progress toward goodness not by stupendous miracles that defy rational explanation, but by small acts of quiet heroism, by a word fitly spoken in somebody's moment of grief, by a hand that touches your shoulder hesitantly, but transmits a world of unspoken love. The good news is you can perform those miracles.